From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Philippe Gély, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is the White House Correspondent for the Weekly Standard, Michael Warren.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Outrage over the Trump administration's policy of separating children from their immigrant parents apprehended for crossing the U.S. border illegally. After days of confused messages from the White House, President Trump signed an executive order claiming to change the policy and demanding Congress take action. What happens next? Markets not responding well to the potential for more retaliatory action from Beijing to new U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods. The Trump trade wars heat up. And the U.S. government identifies the missile testing site North Korea has pledged to destroy. Well, let's go back first to the big story of the week here, which is the Trump administration's immigration policy separating families. The administration and the White House seems to have reversed itself, although it's not entirely clear. Philippe, can you give us a little bit of an update about what exactly is the policy now of the Trump administration?
That's a tough one. I think there is a lot of confusion at this point. You have the Border Patrol essentially saying that they don't refer anymore families, migrants with children, to the criminal prosecution system. On the other hand, you have the Department of Justice saying that nothing has changed, that it is still a zero tolerance policy. In the middle of that, you have the Pentagon, who's been requested to accommodate up to 20,000 unaccompanied minors. So really, when you look at what's going on in Washington as well as on the border itself, nobody really seems to know what is exactly the federal policy now.
And Tom, I was struck by the way in which the administration seemed to turn pretty quickly just a week before, defending this policy. Some figures saying it was biblically appropriate, saying that this, of course, was exactly what President Trump ran on, tough on the border. The president himself sort of backing away, not really owning his own policy. What happened here? How did the political outrage over this separation change what happened within the administration?
We have said for years, Michael, we've all used the old cliche that a picture is worth a thousand words. I think here a picture is worth a million words, maybe more. I was reminded of that powerful image of President George W. Bush looking out the window of Air Force One day, looking at the flooding, severe flooding in New Orleans from Hurricane Katrina. And that photo, which was seized upon by opponents as showing that he didn't have the time to go down and see people with family members who had died and who had been flooded from their homes. That picture became a powerful and negative optic. And I think one picture last week that has gone viral around the world of a little girl crying hysterically as her mother was patted down by some law enforcement person on the border, I think has galvanized public opinion. So what happened is I think the bottom fell out of public opinion on the Republican side. Even many of President Trump's most ardent supporters decided that this was a bridge too far, it was not wise, it was not humane, and that coupled with the optics, plus the fact of at least 2,300 children have been separated from their parents and they're scattered all over the country now, it just was a bad situation. And then I think the conflicting versions of what was going on. I mean, there was one day President Trump said, after critics said this is a Trump policy, he can end it with a phone call to the Department of Homeland Security. He said, you can't do this with an executive order. Well, 2 days later, he did this with an executive order. So there is a level of chaos that people who cover the White House routinely have seen. But I think this was a combination of chaos plus terrible optics, which combined to make a perfect bad storm for the Trump administration.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. The chaos was normal. It was the way in which the issue really got away from the administration and the White House that seems to suggest this has a different ending. But let's go back to the question of blame, the question of who can actually fix this. Philippe, we had this executive order signed on Wednesday. The president insisted in his remarks that really the real issue here was that Congress needed to act and needed to act quickly in order to change the policy that, of course, Trump's own administration had been initiating. But now we see Friday morning the president tweeting that actually immigration is a distraction and what Congress really needs to do is wait until more Republicans are in Congress, have greater control. They have control now. It's the elections in November. Polling suggests that Republicans may not increase their margins there. But now he's saying that it's not important at the moment to address this immigration issue in Congress. What is the future of any kind of fix or solution to what's going on the border in Congress and in Washington?
Well, I mean, it's a perpetuation of the chaos that Tom mentioned. I mean, it goes from the top. And we know that Congress has been unable to fix the immigration laws for the past 15 years. And they've been trying, but they can't agree. Even the Republican majority in the House was not able to agree on one version of the law that was pretty hardline. And they anticipate that they will have a hard time finding a majority for a more moderate version of the law that they were supposed to vote upon on Friday, and that is now postponed. So what is the future? How can you know? I mean, the president, I think what you mentioned about the optics, Tom, is very true, but they had planned and anticipated this policy for months. And the optics were exactly what they were looking for, because they thought that that would not only deter immigrants to enter the country, but also play as a leverage for Congress to act. It failed. And it failed in part also because President Trump himself couldn't stand his own policy and decided to cancel it by the whiff of a pen. And what has not been anticipated is that decision to get back on and to cancel his policy. So now we're in outer space, I would say, on this.
Michael, I think President Trump was hoping to use his leverage what's happening at the border, and by saying, all right, we're not going to separate families from their children, from their parents any longer. He wanted to put that into an omnibus immigration bill, which gave him several things that he really wants to see passed, most notably $25 billion to build a border wall along the Mexican border, plus some other changes to immigration. He wanted to get rid of a lottery system. He wanted to reduce legal immigration, several other things. And he thought that if he could do what he did by executive order, that would make it easier to get that kind of legislation. Also, he was going to throw in some protection for the so-called dreamers, young Americans who were brought here as infants or young children 20 years ago with their parents. He wanted to give them some protection as well, and he thought all of this might be a package that, taken as a whole, could pass Congress, but that didn't happen. So now it just seems like they're nowhere. I mean, I think the president's tweet that you mentioned about let's wait till after the November elections, I think tells you that House Republican leaders told him, Mr. President, neither one of these bills is going to pass. You don't have the votes to pass a more conservative one, and you don't have the votes even to pass a more supposed moderate conservative proposal. And rather than take embarrassing votes that would lose, they've decided to go south.
Now, while all of these deliberations are happening on Capitol Hill in Washington, we saw the First Lady, Melania Trump, travel down to the border to one of the facilities. I believe it was not a facility where the specific families who had been separated, where the children of those families were being held, but another facility for unaccompanied minors who had crossed the border. But this was supposed to be a moment, an event that showed perhaps compassion from the wife of the president. Philippe, how did Melania Trump's trip down to the border go, and did it exacerbate or solve the White House and the administration's PR problems?
Well, I think it did neither of those options. It ended up being a strange diversion, I think, on the whole thing, essentially because of this jacket story. When you travel to that day, is supposed to be devoted to separated families and children separated from their parents. And when you board the official plane with a jacket saying, I really don't care, do you? Which was written on the back of the jacket. Of course, it's a very strange start. Then she takes the jacket off. She meets the children. She seems to be a little bit floating in the air. When you listen to the questions, when you see that she finds okay that it takes at least 2 months to reunite a kid with his parents and this sort of things. And then there is the return to Washington where she puts the jacket back on. And the president argues that this was intended to troll the fake news media. Well, you're right. I think it was an effort to show some compassion, which has been scarce in the past few days when you know that the president said in a meeting with the Republicans in Congress that the images doesn't look good politically. Plus, you had a former advisor saying that, you know, womp-womp when he was mentioned the story of a trisomic kid being held at the border, and you had also Ann Coulter saying that those were child actors. I mean, all those quotes added up to a really bad impression on the public, I think.
Every time they said something or their supporters said something around the Trump White House, it was discordant. You had a Fox News person, Laura Ingraham, in one of her shows referring to these children in large cages, saying it was akin to summer camps. That was an optic that didn't work so well either. And so it's just the White House knows they have a problem, but they're not sure how they get out of it at this point. And it'll be very interesting to see what the next round of public opinion polls tells us about how the American people think about this.
Well, we'll have to wait and see what those polls say and what they say about how Americans really have responded to all of this. We are going to take a quick break here, and we'll be right back with more Issues.
You're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America from Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Philippe Gelly, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is Michael Warren, the White House correspondent for The Weekly Standard.
And we are back talking about Trump trade wars, new tariffs, new efforts to push back against what the president refers to as losing trade deals. Tom, I want to start with you. What's going on with respect to the Chinese reaction to these efforts by the Trump administration to put more tariffs on Chinese imports?
Well, the Chinese are reacting, I guess, predictably. They're not happy. And more to the point, you could always argue, well, leaders can get together and say, look, I know you have to say what you have to say, and I have to know what I have to say, what I have to say. Let's don't worry about it. But I think the Chinese attitude is, we are going to see your tariffs, and we're going to raise you by slapping tariffs of our own on your products. It seems like the Chinese are not happy. They're not pleased at all. And you also get a feeling the Trump administration may be a little disconcerted that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has been to Beijing a couple times since the celebrated meeting with President Trump in Singapore just a handful of weeks ago. And there is some buzzing in the White House that maybe the Chinese have another game here going with the North Koreans to help them with their sanctions. So trade wars are not good. Everybody knows trade wars usually don't work. And the Chinese, I think, who are sensing that they are becoming more muscular and more of a global presence, especially in places like these previously unoccupied islands in the Pacific Ocean that are now becoming heavily populated largely by military installations by the People's Liberation Army. I think this is going to be a new and perhaps enduring source of friction between the Chinese and the U.S.
I think it's worth returning to that question of how this trade discussion plays into the national security discussion with North Korea. But, Philippe, I want to turn to how the markets are reacting to this heating up trade war. And also, of course, there are tariffs that are affecting not just countries like China, with which the United States has a complicated relationship, but even with allies, the G7 nations, Canada, and the European Union. How are these allies looking at the latest developments with the United States and China and more tariffs?
I think they are coming to the realization that with President Trump, you have to use the same language. I mean, you cannot play nice if he wants to play tough. And as so many times before, I mean, there are issues that are correctly identified by this president. I mean, regarding Chinese practices in terms of trade and intellectual property and the way they coerce Western companies to transfer the know-how in order for them to get to access the Chinese market. There is an issue there. The right way to address it was to team up with the Europeans and the Canadians and oppose a united front to China and have a strategy. Now we are on the brink of a trade war. Why? Because we are in this game where who blinks first? And that's the question. We are still at the stage of threats because it takes quite a while to implement them. The first stage will be on July 6th when they strike roughly 800 products worth $34 billion. But the European sanctions are already started. Have already started on June 22nd with $3 billion. Well, it's symbolic. Maybe it's oranges from Florida and corn and Harley Davidson's and Bourbon and this kind of stuff. But it can escalate. And I don't see this administration having a strategy on the long, on even on the medium term.
And I think that the domestic effect of a potential trade war, there is already, you're seeing in polling at various states, whether it's Wisconsin, Nebraska, other parts of the country that are states that President Trump won, but have a big sector of their own economies is agriculture. We're seeing that the Chinese retaliation is targeting exactly that. Tom, can you talk a little bit about how this could hurt or affect otherwise Trump himself in a lot of these areas that has supported him in the past as trade wars affect these parts of the country's livelihoods?
We've all said, I think, Michael, for years that basically elections can turn on various issues, but pocketbook issues are always one of those issues. And I think President Trump has prided himself on passing a tax bill, which he has said will make the average American family feel like they have more money in their pocket at the end of the month. But if you're in an agricultural state like Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, places like this that were overwhelmingly supportive of President Trump in the 2016 election, these are states that could really get hit hard by the proposed tariffs that the Chinese are talking about retaliating against President Trump about. And those are, I mean, some cynics might say, well, he's going to win Iowa no matter what, or he's going to win Kansas no matter what. But we're talking now about congressional elections in November and not the 2020 election, presidential election. And the November elections, which are now 4.5 months away, not a long time, are the first opportunity for the country via congressional elections it offers a referendum of sorts on President Trump. And traditionally, the party in power loses seats. So it might be a way for, let's say, the farmers who produce corn in Iowa to send a message to the administration, we're with you, Mr. President, but we're going to take it out on your candidate in the 4th Congressional District of Iowa, let's say. So it is a political threat to the president. In the larger sense, a trade war. Trade war has almost always proved to be mutually not beneficial, to put it mildly.
And I know from my own reporting on this issue, it's not even the agriculture sector alone. The president likes to talk about how nothing is manufactured in the United States, but people who know the industry know that we do manufacture quite a bit here in the United States, smaller parts that are a part of a global economy that very well may be affected. And you are hearing from these folks a lot of concern about what a trade war could mean for their businesses as well. But I want to get back to something that Tom touched on earlier, Philippe, which is how all of this and more developments affect what happened just less than 2 weeks ago in Singapore, the summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. We've seen the North Korean dictator traveling to China since then to meet with President Xi Jinping. We learned from the United States government that the missile testing site that President Trump mentioned the North Koreans had agreed to dismantle has been identified. Can you give us a sense of where some of the promises that were made in Singapore, where they stand now, nearly 2 weeks from that historic summit?
Well, the promises made in Singapore were pretty vague and general. So I agree with Tom. If there is a connection between the trade war with China and North Korea, maybe it's that the White House is angry with Xi Jinping, or that they think that now that they have a direct relationship with North Korea, they don't need it anymore. And also probably that they see that the China is already relaxing its control at the border. But what happened in North Korea, in Singapore was basically, as I see it, more a political deal than a disarmament deal. A disarmament deal is a very complex and technical thing. What we had in Singapore was a very broad, general, and almost philosophical agreement. Some say, especially in the peninsula, in the Korean peninsula, that basically what the president, the American president, said to Kim Jong-un was, okay, be a nice boy until 2020. Don't do any more tests, don't do any more provocation, missile firings, and so on. And I won't be that demanding on things. You can destroy a few symbolic things. So be quiet, and I'll look the other way. I don't have a definitive proof that this is what happened, but really, going to Singapore, and I went there, I was like a little bit anxious, you know. Well, I will have to become an expert on nuclear disarmament to try to analyze and understand the agreement that may come out of this. Well, obviously they spared us this task. I mean, it was five paragraphs, and it was frankly a little bit ridiculous.
But the administration insists and has insisted, particularly Secretary Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, that these promises from this agreement, of course, are all contingent on North Korea changing its behavior, and that the maximum pressure campaign, which is the terminology that the administration uses to describe its toughening of sanctions on North Korea, will remain. We've seen some evidence that actually that maximum pressure campaign, Tom, has pulled back, and certainly the Chinese, as Philippe has mentioned, are showing a more openness now that the Trump administration could have previously pointed to as saying they had gotten the Chinese on board to on this maximum pressure campaign. How can we evaluate the changes that we've seen over the last 2 weeks, and how that lines up with the administration's rhetoric?
Well, it's hard to evaluate, Michael. It's difficult to do that. I suspect there are going to be some more baby steps, or what you might call confidence building steps. I wouldn't be surprised if in the next few weeks or months there will be diplomatic missions sent to both world capitals here, kind of like what the U.S. did before we had formal relations with the People's Republic of China. That we had a U.S. representative who happened to be George H.W. Bush, later vice president, later president of the United States. So I think that will happen, and you get the feeling that there's not going to be missile tests around the corner from North Korea. So the president will be able to point to some positive measures, but in terms of changing the grand dynamic, it's hard to know. I mean, the president has said as recently as the last couple of days that the threat of nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula has essentially disappeared. Well, probably in the short term he's right, but that doesn't make a denuclearization.
It may be neutralized more than disappeared.
Right, exactly right. It's mitigated for the moment, but who knows what happens down the road. I mean, even President Trump has said these sorts of things will take years.
Exactly.
To get resolved.
Well, I think the president may be the only person in Washington or his administration who really would say publicly that the nuclear threat is no more from North Korea. Well, that's all the time we have. Thanks to Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and to Philippe Gelly, U.S. chief correspondent for Le Figaro. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Warren, White House correspondent for The Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.